It is 8:08 in the morning and 35 hours to go on KPFA's Fun Drive. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
I'm Antonia Yuhas. We're joined in studio today by Inesha Roychowdhury. She is a Brooklyn-based writer, editor, and educator. Her work has appeared in publications including Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, The Nation and Salon, and many others. She is co-founder of Speech Act, an organization working at the intersection of storytelling and social justice. Her latest book is The Marginalized Majority, Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start with two stories that you framed the introduction to the book with. They're both deeply personal and powerful. Let's start with the first story about your Uncle Bill.
Sure. Yeah. So my parents come from different backgrounds. My mother is white American. Her family's been here for a couple generations. And my father is from India, and he came here in his 20s. So what happened growing up is there was an uncle on my mom's side of the family by marriage. And when I used to go visit the whole extended family there, I experienced this when I was a child of him not interacting with me. And I didn't quite understand it. Basically, he didn't believe in what he called mixed marriage. And obviously, because my parents come from different backgrounds, he did not approve. And what this looked like was basically he just never acknowledged my presence. So around the dinner table, just any time we were around each other, he never looked at me and he never spoke to me. So, and that was something that as a child, I just sort of rolled with, as most children do. They just kind of, you know, take in whatever's around them and you assume it's somewhat normal. And it wasn't until I was much older that I started to really unpack how that impacted me. And also, I feel like I'm appreciative of the experience in that I feel like it's very emblematic of just how deeply embedded racism is in our culture. And I think so many Americans can relate. Like, everyone has usually a friend or family member or someone who, whether it's misogyny or racism, there's just something that it's like, oh, well, that's, you know, that's Uncle So-and-so. So I talk about that in the beginning of the book because I feel like it's a way into talking about a very fraught topic that affects us all. And the book is very political, but it's very much premised on the notion that these really personal experiences are profoundly political.
And one of the obviously overriding themes of the book is the power and strength of narrative. And can you describe why beginning the entire book with a very personal and hurtful story as well, because you were reflecting on a photograph from a particular family dinner that you say you didn't really recall what had happened at that dinner, and then your mother reminds you and what happened there, but then why it's important to start from that place.
Sure, yeah. So basically, that whole episode with my Uncle Bill is something that obviously has stayed with me, and yet at the same time, I really minimalized it and diminished its importance. And I think a lot of us do that just to forge ahead, right? It's like, I want to live the life I want to live here. I want to feel as though I have the ability to thrive in this country. And so there are certain narratives that disrupt that sense of self and freedom. And I think that was one of them. And I kind of suppressed that. So in that opening story, I talk about how it was going through a family album and seeing a photo of the whole extended family, and everyone has these smiling faces except for me. And I assumed that I was making this grumpy face just because it was around like adolescence. So I was like, wow, that's par for the course. But then when my mother's reaction to that photo, when I was kind of joking about my face, she got very quiet. And I was like, well, what's that about? And she said, well, if you don't remember, it's best. Which, of course, you know, as a journalist, investigative journalist and storyteller, I was like, no, you're going to have to tell me more. And so she did. And, you know, she was like, well, what happened is your uncle had a video camera. This was, you know, it was my grandparents' wedding anniversary. And we were all out celebrating, and he had gone around the table with his video camera and introduced each person and who they were, and then just skipped over us when he got to us. And so that was a moment of being reminded as a grown adult of, and it was interesting to have this photographic evidence because I have really minimized it until I really became an adult, and occasionally it would occur to me and I would think about it. But it was seeing my face as a young person and seeing evidence of the fact that this really had impacted me, that gave me pause and made me realize that this was something I needed to unpack and explore. And again, I think this is far from unique in terms of what many of us, especially who are marginalized people in America, experience.
And so that story in many ways is a story of almost erasure and powerlessness. But the introduction then goes on to end with a story of really reclaiming and taking voice and power in a place that many of us feel powerless, which is on a subway car.
Yeah.
And using your own voice on the New York subway to take over from what many of us would just experience as something that is a very powerlessness experience. And if you could recount that story and then why you chose to use that as these two stories as the brackets for the introduction leading us into the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, when I talk about that experience of my uncle and that whole chapter in my childhood that then, you know, would resurface occasionally over time as an adult, it was a reminder of the fact that I never really wanted to rock the boat, right? There was this whole family structure and, you know, I was just sort of trying to make sure everyone got along and minimized the impact of that experience on me. And I think that sort of builds up over time. And there was a moment a few years ago where I was on a crowded subway train and a man got on and just sort of started spewing this really hateful racist rhetoric. And I had this moment of, I leaned against the doors, I closed my eyes, and I thought, okay, he will get off soon and we won't have to listen to him anymore. But he didn't get off the train and he kept going on. And my fellow New Yorkers were doing their job of trying to tell him to be quiet, but he would not stop. And in that moment, I thought I kind of had a flashback to that experience of my uncle and of doing the same kind of thing of just kind of closing my eyes and tolerating it. And I was looking around that train car and I was like, but no one here wants to hear this. So why? Why do we have to? He is the minority here. So I told him that if he didn't stop, I would start singing, which he just looked at me sort of perplexed. It didn't seem like much of a threat. And then he kept going. So I started singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, which I just couldn't think of any other song on the spot. And at first it was just me singing with, you know, a warbly voice because I was nervous and I don't have the best voice. But before long, a few other folks joined in. And then there were a couple kids in strollers who started singing along, clapping their hands. And this guy tried to get louder to combat us, but we outnumbered him. And within a few stops, he had to get off because we were too loud. Pretty much everyone on that train car was singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, at which point I started to get cocky and was like starting rounds. You know, we're singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat in rounds. But I think my favorite part of that moment was that even after he got off the train, we kept singing. And there was just such a joyousness and everyone looking at each other and singing and recognizing. And I think what I read that as is we recognized our power, that we could take back the space, that we didn't have to endure it. And also importantly, we didn't have to just respond to him, right? There were people who had been disagreeing with him and arguing with him and telling him to be quiet. But in this way of singing over him, we didn't even have to engage with him. We had our own agenda entirely. And I think I tell that story because after the election of Trump, I think a lot of us are in that space of feeling like we're trying to argue back. We're trying to engage in some way because we're so appalled and we just want it to stop. And it occurred to me that he and the handful of people in power around him, this is a handful of extremists. But we as Americans, the many marginalized folks in this country who do make up the majority, and we can unpack that later, we do have the power. And maybe there is a way in which we can take that back and claim that without having to constantly be sort of defensive and engaging with that handful of extremist voices, basically not letting them set the terms.
So that starts off the introduction to the book. And I think the book is ultimately a testament against cynicism. It brought to mind for me Rebecca Solnit's book, Hope in the Dark, written during the depths of the Bush administration, an administration which also profoundly impacted you, your work, and your life. And can you talk about why you believe the cynicism pervades at this time, what you think is causing it, and what's different now, if anything, about that cynicism from during the Bush administration to today during the Trump administration?
Yeah. Yeah, in the book, I kind of unpack how cynicism has evolved over time. And the original concept meant a radical truth-telling. So telling the truth no matter the repercussions in the face of power. And I think the way we understand cynicism today and practice it, unfortunately, is this knowingness, this savviness, the sense of you can't surprise me with how horrible things are. And if people in power are corrupt and doing horrendous things, that's only what we can expect of them. So I am not surprised. And the problem is that this creates a kind of degradation in our discourse. And we end up, you know, I say in the book that Trump is not, he's not the problem. I mean, he's obviously a major problem, but he's evidence of an ongoing problem that has been around for a long time. And cynicism is a huge part of that. Basically, if we are expecting people in power to behave horrendously, we're just sort of feeding into this system of people who are as cynical as our expectations. And obviously, it's not just everyday Americans. It's larger institutions as well. And I talk a lot about how media and journalism has reinforced this notion of cynicism. And a great example of that, where we see it all the time, is in the coverage of protests. So there's this fascinating dissonance in terms of how we talk about protests in the past versus present. You know, and like the civil rights movements and era is totally emblematic of that. Right. Like if you talk to the majority of Americans today, they say, yes, of course, we need the civil rights movement, the freedom riders, the people who were protesting at lunch counters, the sit-ins. But of course, at the time, those protests were not popular among Americans. And, you know, we see the same thing in Vietnam War protests. At the time, most Americans were like, nah, I don't know. Do you guys really need to be protesting this? But fast forward a decade or so, and the majority of Americans have positive perspectives and views. It's this notion almost that it's inevitable. Like, of course, this is just, you know, this is what needed to happen for justice and equality. But then when you look at protests, more contemporary protests like Occupy Wall Street, like Black Lives Matter, we again see the same kind of thing. Now, I think there's the percentage-wise, the breakdown, there are more Americans who do support these contemporary movements, but it's still not a majority in a lot of polls. So I think I'm hoping that if we see this dissonance, we can hopefully minimize the time between, you know, recognizing that these are protest movements that are engaging with extremely urgent and necessary issues, and hopefully not wait a decade or more to recognize that and get on board with it. At the very least, to not dismiss these protest movements as unimportant or distractions. But again, it is often the way journalists cover protests. So I talk in the book, I do a roundup of, like, say, the Women's March, which was unprecedented in terms of numbers. And this was happening around the world that people were coming out. And there was just such a bevy of headlines that were like, why the women's protest failed, why it's going to fail. Basically, before, during, after, there was such a cacophony of this isn't enough or it's a failure. And obviously, the protest did not lead to Trump resigning, right? Trump is still in the White House. But that's the interesting thing about how we think and talk about protest is just because a very concrete, clear end does not happen within, you know, days or weeks of a protest doesn't mean that it's not having a vital impact. And a really powerful impact of protest is simply solidifying the fact that there is a movement, right? And recognizing each other. We have this notion that preaching to the choir is a bad idea, which obviously you don't want to get caught up in only speaking to each other. But I think we're in a place right now where we're just recognizing who that choir is and solidifying that, which is, again, the majority of Americans. That's really vital work.
The radical transformational power of row, row, row your boat, sung in unison. Those are the words of Anisha Rochow-Dorey. She is the author of the brand new book, The Marginalized Majority, Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. And she joined us here at KPFA. You can also hear her speaking tonight at 7 o'clock tonight at East Bay Booksellers in Oakland. We're going to return now to that interview. One of the things you focus on in the book, which I found very important, was a critique of the media, which is how we'll almost never see a headline that says protest movement led to X policy change. This organizing, this protest led to this outcome.
Yeah.
Partly it's because sometimes it takes too long. You can't necessarily see the organizing that leads to the end result. But also there seems to be a genuine unwillingness to tell that story and to explain change in that way.
Yeah, I think, yes, and I think that it's a muscle. It's a muscle that I think we as journalists need to build because there is this, I think, a term that I use in the book that is understood in media criticism is fairness bias, right? So there's this extreme focus on seeming even-handed, and I think what can happen is journalists look at protests and they think, oh, well, maybe this is sort of an extreme. I want to make sure that I'm getting, quote unquote, both sides of the story. But it's this sort of hewing to a tone of objectivity. And I think the real problem is that we don't define that term very well in journalism. So in most newsrooms, it's just accepted that we should all be striving for an objective voice and tone. But without defining that, all you're doing is sort of reflecting whatever the status quo is. So right now we have a handful of extremists in power, right? And one of the reasons that I wrote this book is because immediately after the election, there were so many headlines and this very pervasive narrative around the fact that we've never been more divided as Americans. In reality, if you look at the policy level and what the majority of Americans want, we are aligned in a lot of ways, whether it's access to education, healthcare. The majority of Americans want these things, but we have this handful of extremists in power who are not at all giving us those. In fact, they're working in opposition to that. So I think what happens is if you are just sort of without examining what objective means, you're just going to keep shifting. And if you have a handful of extremists who are dictating the terms of the narrative, then we're just going to keep pulling in that direction when in reality, the majority of Americans want different things than are being addressed. Mm. So I think that that is the key underlying problem. We really need to figure out what we mean by objectivity. And so, you know, when we see coverage of protests, we're seeing that in effect as well. There's this remove. There's this sense of, okay, I'm going to cover, you know, the fact that this is an unprecedented number of people who have come out. But what does that mean, that it was an unprecedented? What do these people want? Like, that's where the journalists need to go. They need to be speaking to Americans. They need to be letting what Americans are saying, doing, feeling be driving the coverage rather than this more top-down following people in power. And I think we saw the failure of that approach in the lead-up to the presidential election when everyone was saying, well, of course Hillary Clinton's going to win. So I think journalists are starting to understand that. And part of it, you know, there are plenty of journalists, too, that I have spoken to who are colleagues of mine who have been trying to do this on-the-ground coverage. But because higher-up editors are dictating the terms, they aren't able to. And that is, and there are journalists, and I talk about this in the book, there are journalists who have been fired for attending protests, for speaking out about just this need to unpack what we mean by objectivity. And that's really troubling. That gets into the realm of censorship. And I don't know that a lot of Americans know about that. And this continues to happen with major newspapers basically restricting journalists from attending protests, engaging in social media, even privately in their private accounts in any way. And the question that occurred to me as I was researching this and writing this book is, what does it mean? You know, we're talking about journalists often are not making a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. They have the same struggles that a lot of Americans have in terms of keeping a roof over their heads, and food and handling all their bills. So, you know, there are journalists who have attended Occupy Wall Street protests and were then fired. And, you know, there was one journalist who was fired, and the defense of the radio station of that firing, they said, well, when she chose to make herself part of the story, she basically then lost her journalistic credibility. And I thought, well, wasn't she already part of the story by just being an American and a citizen? So yeah, the question that occurred to me was, what does it mean when your responsibilities and needs as a citizen are at odds with your responsibilities as a journalist? And I think that's something we really need to think about and focus on.
Well, and also when so much of the necessity of journalism right now is to question the status quo, is to question the establishment doctrine that is pervading policy choices, that is pervading the policies that are impacting all of us.
Yeah.
When much of who is in power in the media are people who are also benefiting as part of that establishment.
Yeah.
And so they don't need to be part of the story of those who are impacted negatively by those policies, because they are being impacted by them positively.
Yeah.
So all of us who are part of the story of the negative impacts of policies or social, what are now considered social norms or what is the status quo, are all inherently part of the story, as you say, and need to be writing about it and
Absolutely.
Reporting on it. And one of the sentences that you wrote in the book that I found very important was, it's time for journalists and pundits to examine their responsibilities and the role they wish to play in a democracy that has gone off the rails. The story of American democracy isn't a story whose ending is already written.
Yeah.
Why did you feel it was important to essentially include that call to activism, essentially, among journalists as well?
I mean, honestly, I feel like most journalists recognize that this is a really challenging time and are feeling pressures to cover things in a sort of business as usual way, and feeling that that's not quite right, but maybe not knowing, well, what am I supposed to do here? You know? So I sort of put the call out, and because I'm hoping that that little voice, or maybe that loud voice, quite loud voice within, can be directed towards doing the work of thinking about our responsibility. I mean, journalism, without journalism, it's just such a core tenet of democracy. And if journalists and everyday American citizens too, just sort of look at our political system as like, well, yep, that's what it is. And it's terrible, but what are we supposed to do about it? Everyone's so corrupt. It's like, that's just not true. That's not how things work. When the majority of Americans, or even when a small group of rowdy Americans continue to persist and call into question fundamental hypocrisy and the refusal of leadership to address our needs, things happen. And I think that if we right now, journalists and Americans, you know, and American journalists, all of us, sit this out, kind of bury our heads in the sand or get pushed back on our heels, which is, I think, part of what we did during the two terms of Bush 2, that's going to be really detrimental. And I think now more than ever, we need to recognize that the majority of us do want the same things, and that we do have the power, if we are vocal, to change things.
A lot of what you've pointed to in the book is what has gone wrong is simply the way that we talk about these two ideas. which has led to a sense of powerlessness among so many Americans.
Yeah, I mean, I use examples from the civil rights era. So, you know, like if we think about history textbooks, I know that I was introduced to, say, Rosa Parks as like this sort of sweet grandmother type figure who, you know, she was just tired on that bus and she was like, you know what, not today because I'm tired. Which totally erases the reality of that situation, which is that she was not that old. She was in her 40s. Mm-hmm. There was great intentionality behind that action. She was a member of the NAACP for 12 years. This was a choreographed action that had been thought through immensely. She was one in a line of many, many Black Americans who engaged in this kind of protest of refusing to move on a bus. So I think the way that we flatten those kinds of stories tends to make it seem like, oh, well, it's these sort of impromptu events that just, well, it was bound to happen, and then she didn't move, and then now we're equal, you know, or like it was inevitable. And that erases all the quote-unquote failures, which, again, I don't think of as failures, of other Black Americans and protesters who had been doing this and were just arrested, went to jail. Maybe it didn't make headlines, but it took all of that to lead to this moment where someone like Rosa Parks could, and she was chosen as someone who, you know, she was light-skinned, she was, you know, older than some of the younger activists who had been taking part in these activities. So she became the face of this, and it was more palatable to a broader swath of Americans. So, but all the work that it took to get to that point tends to be erased. And I feel like that then influences our sense of protest more generally. And it's like, well, yeah, sure, I did this one action, but it didn't lead to anything. And what's the point of that? What a waste of time. And that's just simply not true. It takes all of that work. It takes all of that pushing forward in order to get to this place. It's not like one action suddenly changes things. And I talk also in the book about ACT UP. And that was in the 80s. They were organizing and doing a lot of organizing around HIV/AIDS. And, you know, we tend to think of protest only being quote unquote successful when it's huge numbers of people, again, sort of coming out in one main event, and then, oh, that's what's going to change things. ACT UP, their protests had, you know, between like 50 and 5,000. Usually it was like much smaller numbers, but they were so loud and so persistent that they were able to, they were successful in getting the FDA to create and do more research, more substantive research that led to drugs that actually, you know, had an impact on addressing the needs. There were just people dying left and right, but because homosexuality was so stigmatized, there wasn't enough will, there wasn't enough political willpower to really address this horrendous thing that was happening across America. But, you know, you get this handful of people, these persistent people who were continuing to organize and continuing to move forward, and you get real change.
Yeah, and that brings up the issue of direct action versus protests, and there's or a typical protest that is, say, a march versus a direct action type of protest, and that there's definitely camps, you know, on either side. One says that this is the only way to do it, and the other way is counterproductive. And can you talk about what is very often a divide within those who agree that the concept of protest is definitely a good thing, but the tactics can divide us?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the divisions that was useful for me in terms of understanding direct action and protest is there are expressive actions and instrumental actions. And often a protest or direct action has some element of both. But we tend to only really value generally instrumental action. So instrumental is like, okay, we're protesting and demanding a change in this specific policy, and you will do this or we will not shut up, right? But expressive actions are kind of like more the seeing each other, creating a moment of solidarity, kind of that preaching to the choir glue that I think is really necessary. And and basically, because we skew so much towards thinking that the only protest that's useful and valuable is instrumental, we lose sight of the role and necessity of expressive action as well.